It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued its Roe versus Wade decision in 1973, it effectively struck down state bans on abortion. But in the 5 decades since that landmark ruling, Wisconsin's pre-Civil War abortion ban still remained on the books. That's in part because the world of abortion politics was vastly different 50 years ago. WPR's Sean Johnson and Anya Van Wagtendonk report on how the political battle lines around abortion were formed.
Just 5 years after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its Roe versus Wade decision, there was an effort in the Wisconsin legislature to restrict the use of Medicaid funds for abortions.
Some of this debate unfolded the way you might imagine, like protests that erupted in the assembly gallery.
The sergeant will clear the gallery. The sergeant will clear the galleries.
Or inflammatory speeches from lawmakers.
This doesn't close the door to these goody-goods that want to have their good times and then say, oh, we made a mistake, and now you got to come and help me out.
A Democratic governor, Martin Schreiber, vetoed the bill.
I know for sure that a pregnant woman is a human being, a person. I, in my own mind, do not know when a fetus becomes a human being, a person.
And legislators felt so strongly about the issue that they tried to override that veto.
But the similarities between this abortion debate in 1978 and the way it's discussed today stop there, because this was a Democratic supermajority legislature pushing for abortion restrictions.
And if it weren't for a handful of Republicans who supported access to abortion, they would have gotten exactly what they wanted.
Republican Representative Sheehan Donahue opposed the bill from the floor of the Wisconsin Assembly.
This is not an easy vote for anyone. Ladies and gentlemen, what you do here today, you will have to live with the rest of your lives.
And Donahue still remembers the debate today.
This legislation, in my opinion, did damage to the equality of women in control over their own bodies.
At this moment in time, the parties were split on abortion throughout the country, says Mary Ziegler, a leading expert on the history of abortion in the post-Roe versus Wade era.
The idea that the Republican Party was the party of life, as Ronald Reagan put it, or the anti-abortion party, and the Democrats were supportive of legal abortion wouldn't really coalesce until the early 80s.
That started to change as politicians faced consequences for their stances on abortion.
Sometimes the consequences were personal. Gary Goyke was a Democratic state senator from Oshkosh. He voted for the bill restricting abortion funds.
But he says the 1978 debate moved him toward a belief in abortion rights. Goyke was Catholic and remembers being confronted at church.
A lady would come sit right in the front row, and at every service that I was at, every mass I was at, she would stand up and say, let us pray that Senator Goyke learns to respect life. And then the parish would say, Lord, hear our prayer, right? And I am sitting right in front. So it was in your face.
For other lawmakers, the issue may have cost them their jobs. When Barbara Lohrmann was first elected as a Republican state senator in 1980, she openly supported abortion access. She says nobody blinked.
You know, almost anybody could fit in either party, frankly.
But by 1994, it was a different story. After the 1990 census, Republicans redrew her district. It got a lot more conservative.
She drew a primary challenge from Scott Fitzgerald, someone she calls a, quote, darling of the right wing. She says anti-abortion activists threw their weight behind him.
Yeah, those are very devoted, conscientious voters. And like overnight, yard signs went up and down the highway. And I saw that and I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be a problem.
Fitzgerald won. He'd later become the Senate's majority leader and now represents the area in Congress.
For Republicans, the shift toward anti-abortion candidates led to anti-abortion laws. Fitzgerald was the lead sponsor of a bill that banned partial birth abortion in Wisconsin.
Democrats were undergoing their own shift toward abortion rights politics. In the 1990 race for attorney general, the Republican incumbent supported overturning Roe versus Wade. His Democratic challenger, Jim Doyle, used it to campaign against him.
That was the number one issue. That's how I got elected. So it really was, it was always a very important issue to me.
But it would be years before Wisconsin Democrats were once again in a position to change abortion laws.
Their chance came in 2009. Doyle was governor by then. His fellow Democrats had just retaken both chambers of the legislature.
Doyle knew the state's dormant pre-Civil War abortion ban was still on the books, and this could be the chance to get rid of it.
This was certainly an issue, and I wanted to do it, to repeal the old law.
But Democrats had the slimmest of majorities in the Wisconsin Assembly, and when it came to abortion, they didn't really have one at all.
Bob Ziegelbauer was one of the legislature's remaining anti-abortion Democrats.
If they asked me, it would be a short conversation. I just said no.
Ziegelbauer says this was clear to everyone in the Democratic caucus. They could work together on some issues, but not on abortion.
He says it was a cordial relationship most of the time, until he supported a Republican measure to restrict abortion.
That was the only time I crossed that line, and that line is pretty bright. They don't want you doing that.
Democratic leaders took away Ziegelbauer's committee chairmanship. Soon after, he left the party.
The Democratic majority was short-lived. 2 years later, a Republican wave election gave the GOP control of the legislature and brought Scott Walker into the governor's office.
I'm pro-life. I've always been pro-life. And I've got a position I think is consistent with many Americans out there.
And Republicans used their power. They pulled state funding from Planned Parenthood. They required patients seeking an abortion to view an ultrasound first. And they passed a 20-week abortion ban.
Anti-abortion victories around the country culminated last year when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade.
For the abortion rights Democratic Party, it was, in some ways, the worst-case scenario. But strictly politically speaking, it's had a galvanizing effect.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who was viewed as vulnerable in his bid for re-election, ran hard on the issue of abortion.
And he won.
Holy mackerel, folks, how about that?
Justice Janet Protasiewicz placed abortion rights front and center in her campaign for state Supreme Court earlier this year.
And she won.
Well, Wisconsin, guess what? We did it. We did it.
She was sworn in last week, giving liberals a majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court for the first time in 15 years.
And that's where things stand now. That state Supreme Court could have the final say on any challenges to Wisconsin's abortion laws. If a pending lawsuit succeeds, the abortion ban could be gone.
Today's Democratic Party is pushing hard for this. But here's the catch. Striking down the 19th century ban would restore the laws that were passed in the years after Roe.
That means abortion restrictions from the late 70s all the way to the Walker years would be back on the books. And the fight over abortion in post-Roe Wisconsin would go on. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Oh, by the way, you can find more from the series at WPR.org/1849. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A summer wave of COVID-19 is underway around the country. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and its COVID tracking dashboard, Wisconsin is not seeing a jump in new hospitalizations. As the virus that causes COVID-19 is continually changing, we hear from you. Call in with a question or comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Catherine Wu is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering science and holds a doctorate in microbiology. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. You reported on how the world is once again seeing a surge in COVID cases for the fourth summer in a row. What does this summer's wave look like so far?
Right. So I think it's kind of tricky to even call it a wave. There are certainly people who would argue that we're not at wave status yet. There's no perfect definition for what constitutes a wave. You know, how steeply is it rising? How high do we go? There's no doubt that cases do seem to be going up, and certainly other indicators are rising, things like test positivity and cases being diagnosed in emergency rooms. But I think there's two things to consider here. First and foremost, even though there is a relative rise from spring's lows, the absolute numbers are still pretty low. You know, this is not a repeat of the Omicron wave or the Delta wave, anything like that. The concern is that cases are indeed rising, but I hope this is not inspiring, you know, crisis-level panic at this point.
Okay, so no crisis-level panic at this point, but how alarmed should people be about the growth in cases?
Well, it's certainly not something that we should be optimistic about. You know, we do, in general, know what makes cases rise when people get together and they spread the virus to each other. This may be an indication that people aren't really taking precautions at this point. I do also think this could be a reflection of the fact that a lot of people are not up to date on their vaccines. So if people are seeing cases rise around them, if they're hearing that their friends are falling ill, if they're really seeing the outbreak play out in real time around them, it may be time to consider taking some precautions. You know, if you have some tests still lying around, maybe take them before you go out. If you've got a mask lying around and you know you're going to be around someone vulnerable or you're going to be in a crowded place indoors, consider putting it on.
Do we know how many Americans at this point are vaccinated? What those numbers look like? And is that affecting why we're not seeing a summer spike?
So I think there's a couple things to consider here. You know, for quite some time now, the majority of Americans have had, a vaccination status of vaccinated. They've gotten at least a couple doses of a COVID vaccine.
Like the primary series.
Years. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. It's been years since those primary series vaccines came out. And I think the bigger issue now is that a lot of people haven't stayed up to date since then. You know, booster uptake was very low last fall. There was another round this past spring for people who are vulnerable. That was also quite low. Interest really seems to have dropped off. And so, you know, while it's really important that a lot of people now have a base level immunity, that is probably keeping a lot of people out of the hospital. I don't want to discount that. The reason we probably are seeing a big rise in cases and at least milder illnesses is because people aren't staying up to date. And that still remains a risk for other issues like long COVID.
We're talking about the recent uptick in COVID cases this summer. Catherine Wu, science reporter at The Atlantic, you can join in with your questions and your comments. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Catherine, turning to the Wisconsin, our health department is reporting that there have been deaths from COVID this month, but not as many as our state saw last August. And the department reported that there were 93 people hospitalized with COVID on July 29th. And this is also lower than last summer when almost 500 people were hospitalized. Is the healthcare system getting better at treating COVID and preventing deaths?
I think so. You know, it's a little complicated because I think with the national emergency ending, a little bit of the availability of certain drugs has gotten a little dicey, and people are certainly getting less access to tests. So I do have some lingering concerns about who's actually able to access early treatment like Paxlovid, which we know can keep people out of the hospital and keep them from dying if taken early enough. But in general, you know, the more years we gain on this virus, the more doctors have a sense of how to treat it, how to handle it. And of course, with immunity in general, at least at this base layer, we are mostly keeping people out of the hospital. And that is a comfort. I don't think we're doing as well as we could be, but it certainly is encouraging and not surprising that things are better than they were at this time last summer.
Are there any reports on what demographic is mostly hospitalized? Is it people with compromised immune systems? Is it hitting elderly people harder this summer?
Yeah, I think as far as, you know, researchers have been able to tell, that is generally the demographic. You know, people already known to be at higher risk. If you're older, if you have an immunocompromising condition, if you have a pre-existing medical condition that raises your risk for COVID-19, that is going to be a big risk factor, and that is likely to be the demographic that remains at risk going forward. That's also, incidentally, the demographic that should most be prioritizing staying up to date on vaccines.
How long are boosters effective? What does it mean to be fully vaccinated? What can you tell us there?
Yeah, honestly, I think the term fully vaccinated has since become a little misleading. Mm-hmm. It's obviously incredibly great to be vaccinated, but fully vaccinated, it has this weird connotation of completion. Like, oh, I'm fully vaccinated. I'm full up. I don't need much more. But I think at this point, you know, we should really be thinking about COVID vaccinations as something that we need to keep up to date on in the same way that you would download a new software update for your phone or your computer, or you'd want to do regular maintenance on a car. You know, we need to basically refresh the body's memory of this virus for two reasons. One, because, you know, the body has limited resources. If other viruses come along, it might start to devote some resources to that. Remind it that the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 is still an issue. And also because this virus is still constantly changing. Really, it's just this coming fall that will be the first time that we are offering people a vaccine that has no more vestiges of the original virus that started the pandemic, you know, more than 3 years ago.
The talking about vaccines, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first COVID vaccine on August 23rd, 2021. How are these vaccines evolving?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question to be considering. You know, we went from the sort of original formulation of the vaccines, which is based on the first version of the virus that scientists were able to detect and sequence. You know, it took us a little while. We eventually went to those bivalent vaccines that were half original, half Omicron. And now the plan is for the FDA to sort of move us over to this new formulation that is also based on something within the Omicron family, but it's in the XBB lineage. So this will be a new vaccine formulation, which makes it important for people to get it. People might have, you know, bells ringing here because it sounds a little bit how we treat flu vaccines. You know, we offer them once a year, every fall, and the idea is to update the vaccine every year to keep pace with the flu virus's evolution. And it seems quite likely that that's going to happen with COVID vaccines as well.
When can people expect to get COVID boosters? What might be the timeline?
Right. So the expected timeline is that these should become available within a month or so, which seems about right. You know, the seasonality of this virus is still probably in flux, and it's not something that scientists yet have a lot of complete clarity on. But it does seem quite likely that a winter surge in cases, I can't say how big or when exactly it'll start, but a winter surge at some point is probably likely. So again, similar idea to the flu vaccine, with the caveat that, of course, COVID is not the flu, but fall is a good time to get that shot, you know, give the immunity some time to build up and get up to date on the latest strains and variants that could be circulating, or something at least that is very similar to them.
And previous COVID vaccines have been paid for by $30 billion in federal funding. Do you anticipate this fall's COVID vaccines to be covered by the federal government?
Yeah, that's a complicated situation. I think, again, since the national emergency and the public health emergency have ended, that does get a little bit more complicated. For the most part, people who want to get these vaccines should be able to get them, which is encouraging. But I think it just gets a little bit more complicated when, you know, public health departments no longer have the funding to do outreach. There are probably more complicated questions for people who are uninsured, though I know there are systems in place that are trying to get vaccines to those people. I think in general, for anyone who has any doubts whatsoever about whether they're eligible or whether they'll be able to access these shots, the best thing to do is ask a provider, ask a pharmacist, and hopefully there will be mechanisms in place to make sure that those vaccines are available. The larger question at this point is making sure that Americans know that these shots are available to them and that they have the will to go seek them out.
Can you talk a bit about the new dominant COVID strain? We've heard it's called Eris. Where it comes from, what the symptoms are like?
So as far as I know, you know, nothing is drastically really different from before. And I think this has really been the case for quite some time. We have been kind of living in an Omicron era for quite some time now. And it's no surprise that the virus continues to evolve. You know, we're seeing these slight modifications to its genetic material that make it easier for it to reinfect people. But, you know, when we see a new variant such as this one, it's not quite the same as switching over from, you know, Delta to Omicron, from Alpha to Delta. Those were much bigger jumps. I think at this point, you know, it's not always useful to fixate too heavily on each individual subvariant, but just know that the virus is continuing to change. We can again start to treat this a little bit like how we treat flu viruses. People aren't necessarily paying attention to every, you know, alphanumeric combination of strains that are appearing every fall and winter, but it's a good idea to stay up to date with vaccines and know that that is a big reason why vaccines must change every year and why people should get different shots every year, because it's really not the same to just stick with what you had before.
Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Wu is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering science. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As tributes to a half century of hip-hop flood in, we're in conversation with Wisconsin's Hip-Hop Artist of the Year from the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards. This is Dig the Dirt off the album Power of the Paragraph by Cujo Mojock. Stage name Cujo, hip-hop and spoken word artist in Green Bay. As we explore music around the state as part of a series of summer conversations, you can call in with a question or comment. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cujo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, who are Wisconsin rappers who inspire you? What musicians do you look up to?
Oh, man. I look up to, honestly, a lot more than just musicians. But let's start with musicians. You know, there's a few guys in the area that have connected me with different scenes in the Wisconsin hip-hop for a long time. There's a dude down in Milwaukee named Brandon Morn, stage name B-Morn. And he was one of the first people to kind of put his arm around my shoulder and say, hey, people need to hear you, and put me on some stages. He actually got me up on a stage on Wisconsin Summerfest on July 4th week back in 2017, I think, just a year or so after we moved here to Wisconsin, my family. So that was pretty awesome to be part of such a huge, iconic festival, really right out of the gate.
How does it feel when you are on stage and performing? What goes through your minds, you know, through your mind as you deliver lyrics, as you hear the beat?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, I get kind of the question a lot of, how do you remember all the words? You know, I have probably like, you know, 60 or 70 songs that I perform live, not usually all in one set. That'd be pretty long, but to choose from. And, you know, it comes to literally thousands and thousands of words. But there's something that happens when you get into the flow of rapping and of recitation, that there's like this muscle memory that triggers, where you don't actually have to be present and thinking about what word comes next, but they just sort of follow each other in the right order if you've repeated it enough times that it becomes kind of part of you, you know?
Wow. Almost like an intention. I mean, your body just knows it. It can feel it. Where do you find your sources of inspiration for your music?
Life, huh. You know, life is the wellspring that is constantly giving us opportunities for self-reflection, for growth, for pain and suffering at times. But honestly, the dark times sometimes make for the best art. And so I try to, when I find myself in times of difficulty or mental strife, you know, I try to pause and just say, like, what's the lesson from this? And how can I share my experience in a way that will help someone else hear what I'm saying and say to themselves, oh, I'm not alone.
You connect with the community, teach music. Your new unreleased song, Breath Control, contains an element of teaching. Let's take a listen.
Breathe out, exhale fully. Breathe deep, deep into your belly. Breathe in, breathe out, exhale fully. breathe deep, now hold it. Breathe free air, it's the one thing that can make you whole. When the whole world is spinning, it's the one thing that you can control. Concentrate on what is within and how much you can let go. When Ram Dass said, be here now, he meant it, hand to soul. This moment's a gift.
So that's you give breathing instructions to us. Did you intend breath control to come across as a form of guidance?
Yeah, I did actually. So my wife, shout out to Trees Yoga, is a yoga instructor of about 18 years, and I've been practicing with her since we met 11 plus years ago now. And it's been transformative for my own life to kind of connect the breath with movement in a really conscious and intentional way. And so I wrote this song, Breath Control, because I've actually done several live performances to her hip hop class, and we host yoga retreats, and so I've hosted breath workshops at her yoga retreats, and this song has kind of been a natural progression of that process of trying to teach people to breathe consciously, to inhale through the nose, exhale completely to empty the lungs of the dead space, the dead air that's in there, and really take a few deep breaths. And it's been pretty amazing to see people's response to this song in particular. And now that I've been performing it for a year or two now, I think, I use it as a way to kind of call the audience back to attention because,
center us.
Yeah, hip hop is so demanding of your intellect and your attention. You know, if you start talking to your friend for a few seconds, you miss a whole part of the philosophy. And so, you know, doing a 2-hour set, for instance, can be kind of a long time to ask people to stay tuned in. And so I use this song as a way to kind of call people back, get on the same vibration with each other, take a few nice deep breaths, you know, calm the mind, and get back to listening.
Now I understand why you name drop the yoga guru Ram Dass in the song. So now I'm starting to understand that connection. Is mindfulness important to your music practice, to your life?
Of course. I mean, what is an unmindful life? Mm. You know, I mean, I've led it at times, but I can tell you that I don't have a lot of significant memories from those times of my life. You know, when I was a younger man, especially college and, you know, maybe a year or two out of college, rudderless and unsure where to go with my life, and, you know, seeking comfort in the aids of, you know, alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, you know, I don't have memories of that time of my life because nothing important was really happening to me. I was just passing time, you know?
Mm. We're talking about hip hop with Cujo, Wisconsin's hip hop rap artist of the year based in Green Bay. You can join in on this music conversation, call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. As we talk about breath control, do you consider music to be a direct form of communication?
At least I certainly consider hip hop and poetry to be a direct form of communication. I think music in general is, for sure, but one of the reasons that I chose hip hop, you know, I was involved musically in several different genres when I was younger. You know, I tried playing the bass guitar in a metal band. I tried playing acoustic guitar, solo singer songwriter stuff, but all of my writing just came out too wordy. You know, I didn't have the skill to capture a complex concept or idea in just that short little refrain, and so I needed the space that hip-hop provided me to get across my thoughts and my philosophy, because I like to break things down and look at them as a whole and look at them from multiple perspectives and try to bring some light to the situation that I'm talking about. And so hip-hop allows me the opportunity to basically write essays then have people listen to them for sometimes hours at a time.
So you can really stretch out with lyrics, stretch out with ideas. What about beats? How do you approach making a beat?
You know, this has been a constant struggle in my professional life. So as we led into the interview, I think you played an instrumental off of my 2017 album, Power of the Paragraph. And that album is special to me because it was a album It was a practice in full self-reliance. So I wrote all the words, I produced all the beats, I recorded in my 1992 Traveler van, actually. I mixed and mastered and pressed the CDs and everything. So I did everything from top to bottom. And I will say my least favorite part is the mixing and mastering, but second to that is beat making. I find beat making and production difficult and frustrating, but doing that full album, doing all those beats for the album, or I believe I did 10 out of the 12 beats. I think I used a couple different producers on that album as well, but doing those beats really gave me an appreciation for producers. And now at this point in my life, I seek out professional producers to make beats for me. So, you know, if you're listening on the air, hit up Cujo Hip Hop, because I'm always in need of beats.
Well, it seems like you have to multitask there, because you are so protective of your lyrics and want to give them the best support that they can. But that means you have to meld the chords and the sounds and the textures and the beats, and that has to all come together just right in order to make those lyrics really stand out. Is that part of the creative process?
It is. I mean, I've found, you know, yes, making the beats is rewarding, because I can shape them, you know, perfectly to meet the tone and the mood of the song that I've written. But I find much more joy in working side by side with a producer. So on my most recent release titled Light Work, that whole album is produced and mastered by a producer here in Green Bay. That's a good friend of mine, Grace Flo. And in doing that album, me and Grace sat down side by side at the studio. He would show me some beat ideas, and I would ask him to tweak them or add instruments or subtract instruments or create a little bridge right here or drop out the drums during this part so I can have some emphasis on the words. And that was just such an incredible experience to be able to work side by side with a producer to put two heads together on the project. And it's just, you know, it's a cliche, but two heads are better than one. So I'm really blessed to have worked with him on that album, because I think you can really see that both of us are captured in that album, as opposed to just Cujo. You get what it feels like when you mix Grace and Cujo together on that Lightwork EP.
Green Bay-based hip-hop artist Cujo also works with kids and adults teaching poetry and songwriting. We'll talk more about that. This is called Black and Blue off of Cujo's Power of the Paragraph album, as we explore winners of the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At a moment of reflections pouring in on five decades of hip-hop, we hear from Wisconsin's hip-hop slash rap artist of the year by the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards. This is Black and Blue by Cujo, hip-hop and spoken word artist in Green Bay. Be part of the music conversation. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cujo, we heard from Alex in Green Bay and wrote that you continue to inspire youth in the Green Bay area, including at the Boys and Girls Club as a teaching artist. Can you talk about that experience and what it means?
Oh, man, I'm glad you brought that up. And, of course, it's Alex who dials in with that info. Alex is really responsible for me diversifying my professional pursuit into education. He probably came to several of my shows, but after one of my shows, Alex approached me. At the time, he was a youth arts director at the Boys and Girls Club. And he said to me, "Have you ever thought about teaching this to youth?" And my reply was, "No." No, I have not. But, you know, he was persistent and he said, you know, come talk to me. Let's figure out what you're good at, what you can relay to other people. And I want to bring you into the club and have you teach the young artists there, hip hop songwriting. So that was my first foray into education, was working with Alex and his really awesome group of teens, that he had there at the club. I was there for 2 days a week for 5 weeks, about an hour and a half a day. So what is that? About 15 hours. Hmm. And I really just guided those youth artists to produce their own beat, to sample instruments, to write a full song worth of lyrics, to rap and or sing those lyrics. And then we got to go to NWTC, the Technical College up here in Green Bay, and record them rapping that song. So we have a full completed song that about 10 or 12 teens and preteens had their hands on, so to speak. And it was really just such an eye-opening and incredible experience for me that I have really been chasing that educational element ever since.
How did they surprise you? In what way?
I have children of my own. I have a 10 and a 16-year-old. And they constantly surprise me with not just how capable they are, but how much they understand. You know, I think we often take for granted that kids are ignorant, not willfully ignorant, but just ignorant because they're young people and they're coming up in the world. But I've really learned that they see and they feel a lot more than we acknowledge. And when we give them the opportunity and give them the space and the permission to share their feelings, it's pretty amazing how complex you might find that they are.
Let's take a call now. Mike is joining us from Menominee, Michigan. Mike, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just going to ask Cujo if he had heard of there. It seems like he's an up and coming artist. I surf around Spotify, and he just goes by the letters KXXIV. But he has a song Risk that really caught me and my wife. I kind of stepped back and said, this guy's pretty good for young up and comer. It's from the homework I did, it seems like he's from Waukesha.
In part of that hip-hop community, Cujo, any insights there?
I have not, but I'm writing it down
right now.
To go check him out because, that's how we really expand the family, so to speak, is by sharing new artists that we're interacted with. It can be difficult these days, I think, because as up-and-coming artists, as fledgling artists, or even as established artists, sometimes we get caught in this trap of just trying to blow up, right? Trying to get a million views on YouTube. If I could just have that one banger that everybody has to listen to, that'll make my whole career, you know? And while that may be true, I think we lose sight of the fact that your career can be made right in front of you locally, only reaching, you know, several hundred people. I often use the analogy of, you know, a plumber, for instance, doesn't need a million people to hit him up to plumb their toilets. In fact, he'd be quite overwhelmed and he would have to expand and hire a bunch of other plumbers to handle that kind of a load. And so why, as musicians and artists, do we think that we require millions or at least hundreds of thousands to support our profession, to support our job? I tend to look much more locally and look to my community, get involved with different organizations, different arts organizations, get involved with city leaders, and really figure out how I can make a living right here locally doing what I'm doing.
I was going to jump in here, reintroduce you, talking about hip hop with Cujo, Wisconsin's hip hop rap artist of the year. Could you, I want to turn to the week, this week being the 50th anniversary of hip hop and your song Power of the Paragraph about hip hop, referencing literary devices and addressing, you know, themes of the genre, including gun violence, race, and politics. Let's listen.
But don't call me a shotter. I'll expose you with my words. I will reach into your chakra and I'll realign the earth. I don't hate you, I weep for you to find your worth and claim your soul wisdom, but inside you since your birth. The people have the power and peace is what we deserve. Love is the means and the end of reaching about this curse. Please understand that your strength comes from within. No, you can't be defeated, you can only give in. Lift up and educate those who aren't quite sure where to start. Step one.
So the people have the power and peace is what we deserve. Can you talk about this song and the inspiration behind that line?
You know, looking back at 50 years of hip hop, you know, if I reach back to one of my hip hop elders that inspires me, KRS-One is a leader in the genre and a leader among people. And I have really taken a lot from his approach of using the microphone, using the stage to deliver a message of peace and unity. To deliver a message of wake up, you know, look at how we are being captured by our own words, really. You know, I think there's so much negative attention on hip hop because of its gritty and grimy nature at times. But I also ask audiences to broaden their minds a little bit and keep an open mind about where the artist that's rapping is from. It's one thing to rap about gang violence if you are in the inner city surrounded by gang violence. That's an important perspective for us to hear, even if it's ugly, even if it's really uncomfortable for us to hear about. I think it's important that we hear that truth. But especially now with young artists coming up, I think they almost feel like they have to rap about gun violence or rap about their bravado, rap about how excellent they are as an MC. You know, it's like there are these check boxes that some people feel like they have to mark off, otherwise they won't be treated with respect in hip hop. And I've found that that's just not true. Really, respect in hip hop comes from speaking the truth on the mic, speaking your truth, whatever that looks like. And so for me, I was fortunate to grow up in a very nice area. I've got two parents who care about me, and you know, it's been a pretty good life. And so for me, I rap about kind of the 30,000 foot view of, hey, let's look at how the culture is being used and maybe turn it on its head and start using it for our own benefit.
Cujo, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, could I touch one more thing before we
I'm so sorry. We have to jump out of here. We're out of time. Cujo, hip hop and spoken word artist in Green Bay. This is Dig the Dirt off the album Power the Paragraph. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent on the Ideas Network.